You and your dog are a team. Fuel is best in the field and in life with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Made for hardworking dogs of all ages, every sport formula starts with real meat as the number one ingredient and is specifically formulated to support strength and stamina. Try it today and see why Pro Plan is the official dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com.
Mic check, please.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Ducks Unlimited Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Jennings.
I'm your host, Dr. Mike Brazier.
My name is John Gordon. I'll be your host.
And I'm your host, Katie Burke.
Welcome to the Ducks Unlimited Podcast, the only podcast about all things waterfowl. From hunting insights to science-based discussions about ducks, geese, and issues affecting waterfowl and wetlands conservation in North America. The DU Podcast, sponsored by Purina Pro Plan, the official performance dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Purina Pro Plan, always advancing.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Ducks Unlimited Podcast. This is your host, Katie Burke. And today on the show, I have John Fandry. John is a Wisconsin decoy collector, as well as, I'm sure, other Midwest area decoys. But welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Katie. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm excited to talk to you. We're talking about our mutual friend, Nels, today, and I got a little more information about you. I also joined the Wisconsin Decoy Collectors Facebook group so I could look at all your posts.
Oh, okay. That's becoming quite popular.
Yeah.
Just about every decoy area in the country, I think, has its own Facebook page. It's just amazing. It seems like they sprung up in the last couple of years or so.
Well, it's a nice, easy way to get out a lot of information and connect people. I mean, they do kind of have their pitfalls as well, but it is kind of a good entry point for a lot of people, which is nice.
Sure.
So kind of how we'll do this, John, is what I normally do is I like to kind of start from the beginning, and then kind of work into what you collect now and what that looks for you now that you've been collecting for so many years. But so if you could, tell me what your introduction to the outdoors was like as a kid and that sort of thing.
Okay. It seems like I would follow my father since I can even remember. He was a big duck hunter. It didn't run in the family. My grandfather didn't duck hunt, but when my father got out of the service, he just went crazy for it, and all his friends did. So my earliest memories are out in the marsh. We used to hunt near Horicon quite a bit. And he was a big goose hunter and liked to lease farms yearly or bi-yearly. And it was always a different place. And we'd go, you know, throughout the year, make blinds, check the place out. And I think I remember from the age of eight even dragging bags of decoys out in the field and helping and sitting there. But I didn't actually hunt till I was 11. I believe that was a legal age at that time. But I had shot the gun plenty of times in not hunting situations. So it wasn't, and had the safety training. So it wasn't a complete surprise to me. But it seems like I've been doing it all my life, basically. I think at around that age, my father got a longer lease on a farm, I think about 15 years. Just north of Horicon Marsh. And we did a lot of goose hunting, pheasant hunting, and there was surprisingly good duck hunting on it also. And I think I hunted every possible moment I could.
Okay, so I have a question about Horicon Marsh. We're working on a book about goose hunting and goose decoys and like just all things Canada geese, basically. Do you, and Horicon Marsh plays a big part in that history of the giant Canada goose. So I'm guessing, can you remember when it was slap full? And then can you remember when it was one goose a year?
Yes, I can remember all of that. Way back, it was one goose a day, I think, when I started. But the seasons, there was a quota that had to be met and was often met within a week. Sometimes I think it was a couple of days as the years went by. But we weren't in, and there were different zones around Horicon. And as you progressed away from the refuge, the limits were a little bit more lenient. The seasons were more lenient. And we were away a little bit, enough to get good shooting, but far enough away where you could still enjoy the shooting for a longer time and not be confined in the zone. You had to be in a blind and so forth, and out where we were, you made your own blind wherever you felt like and could walk around and shoot if you felt like it. But I do remember all of that. I remember tags that they gave you for a time. It was a contentious situation. I think the federal people that ran the refuge, they were being pulled by quite a few directions. They didn't want geese to get disease. They wanted to spread out the flock. The farmers were having their crops depleted. And then on the other side, the local people wanted the bird watchers and the hunters up there for business. And the hunters, of course. And I can remember the hunters, at least the groups that I hung around with, they were constantly blaming Illinois people, actually, Wisconsin people. Illinois people don't always get along, but they were blaming them for wanting the geese, where we would shoot one a day. I don't know what they were allowed down there, but the rumors ran rampant that, they were shooting right and left. But I can sympathize with the refuge managers. They were being pulled in many directions at one time. They even resorted to hazing with airplanes to try to get the geese to move out.
What was that population change like? Could you tell how they were concentrating? Was it noticeable?
Well, I hunted with an older guy not too long ago, actually, one of my neighbors that lived near the marsh. And he got his picture and name in the paper. He lived in Mayville, Wisconsin, for shooting a goose. That's how rare it was. And when as far as I can remember, back when I was 8 or 10 or whatever, there was thousands of geese. They were all over. And if you went into the marsh itself, you just wouldn't believe. There was a road that ran across the marsh, and it was just black with geese. People would also lined up as far as you could see just to watch them. So it was a big thing, and it seemed to come all at once, as far as I know. And with that came kind of a wild west, I think you might say, as far as hunting. People were, could hunt on railroad tracks and were doing it and lined up, and it had to be controlled, I think, and they did. And it all turned out for the best, I guess, in the long run.
It's interesting to think what a huge shift in population that was. And then, it's kind of I think in the book we have, we talk about how putting Horicon Marsh there was such a big, obviously it helped the geese, but then on the flip side, it kind of did too much. And allowed for hunters to be able to kind of get to them a little easier because it concentrated them into one section instead of spreading them out. But it's really, sure. it's a cool. It's an interesting story.
Well, one thing you did mention was the giant Canada geese. And when I was young, we really didn't shoot those at all. Those weren't the geese we shot at Horicon. They were, 8-9 pound goose was about average. And that's, of course, has all changed too. Now it's the big Canadians all over the place living in the middle of the city. And so, it's always changing, I guess. And I don't know what the winter we had this last winter, we had very few geese leave here. Even I live on the Mississippi River far west, and we had geese and ducks throughout the whole winter and very big numbers. Didn't bother to leave at all, I don't think. So it changes.
We knew about that down here in Mississippi. We had barely any ducks at all this year, so they didn't come down here really.
One thing here, the ice went out quite early, and I think from yesterday to today, it seems like thousands of bluebills are here. Yesterday there was a couple hundred you see around, and now they're just black. The water out here is black with them everywhere you look.
Right. And that's so an early migration for you, right?
I think it is. It would be, because normally I think there'd be ice here, maybe just about leaving pretty soon, but there would be ice. So I have expected to see different birds here, and my sense of migration is just as skewed up as the birds, because I expected to see birds, you know, certain birds weeks ago, and because the weather was warm, and yet they haven't come yet. So yeah, a constant change.
Yeah, it's been a weird year too. I also turkey hunt, and the turkeys are kind of like, the spring was so early down here, so it's kind of a little crazy here too.
Sure.
So yeah.
Sure.
So sorry, I got us off topic with Horicon, but I was just really interested because I haven't talked to really, we've done all this research for the book, but we haven't really talked to anybody that was hunting there then, and what that was like. So when did you talk about hunting with decoys and helping your dad with decoys, but so when did you get the idea to collect decoys?
Well, that's that's my other half family. My mother was from Vermont, and all her relatives were out there. And when I was young, we lived in Milwaukee in the city, and they thought it would be a good idea if I spent the summers in the country. I thought it would be a good idea too. So they would take me out there shortly after school and come and get me just before school would start again. That went on for quite a few years. And I'd stay with my aunts and uncles and cousins. And I had two aunts that were school teachers, and they tried to instill a little culture into all the cousins. And they would take us to the Shelburne Museum, which is a giant collection of folk art and a big piece of property. And each category of folk art is kind of in its own building. And one of the buildings is called the Dorset House, and it houses the collection of Joel Barber, who is the father of decoy collecting. So I was about 10 years old, I think, when I first walked into the Dorset House, and I was still interested in hunting. So this rang a bell with me. And I remember, I think the whole group had to drag me out of there after an hour or so. As I got older, I believe they left me there and told me to meet them someplace else. But I'd look at all the old decoys, and then those, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but you could actually touch some of the decoys. Like, I can remember a big Joe Lincoln, Massachusetts slat goose that was there. It was just laying on the floor like a kid's toy or something that you could touch. And then they had boats, they had punt guns and skiffs and whatnot. And so I took that all in, and I got back to Wisconsin in September, and I asked my father why we didn't have any old wood decoys. Well, his father didn't hunt, and there was none in the family, but he said he'd ask his buddies, and every one of his buddies were big-time hunters. So amazingly, I think over a couple of years, we accumulated 15 or so decoys that were given to us. And very nice ones. I'd say at least a dozen of those are still in my collection. And he kept looking, you know, they'd, after that initial rush of people giving them stuff, they'd still trickle in, you know, one a year or so, until I actually had a job and had money where I could afford to go out and look in antique shops or, you know, estate sales or whatever, and buy a few on my own. And it just skyrocketed from there. So it was a perfect storm of a Shelburne Museum and a duck hunting background that got me going at the age of 10, mind you.
Yeah, I guess also at 10, you wouldn't even think, okay, you saw these at Shelburne, which is the East Coast. You wouldn't even think to not realize that you may or may not have them at home either, like that there'd be decoys everywhere there's duck hunting.
I can remember a thought that I think I used to have back then, that just about all the decoys you could possibly find were at Shelburne. So when people, my father would say, well, so-and-so is going to give us a decoy, I'd look through their little booklet that they had, and I'd think, oh, I wonder if it's going to be a Shang Wheeler or a Ward Brothers or something. It never was, and none of them I knew the makers of, and not till later.
Yeah.
And,
that's really funny. That is such like a kid's way of thinking, like, oh, they must just be coming from this place that I saw them that one time.
Yeah, I thought every decoy had to be in Shelburne, and everything else was just, overflow of that. But I did get from a couple good friends of my parents, two pair of Gus Smoke decoys, which is one of the top Wisconsin makers. And these people dabbled in antiques, and the birds were overpainted, which is not a a great thing for a decoy collector, but I wouldn't have cared at 10 years old. But instead of stripping them like a lot of people did in those days, they took the overpaint down to the original and did a pretty good job of it. And I looked back for many years and commended them for that, because that was a big thing to take all the paint off of the decoy at that time.
Yeah. So, and it's a lot of work, you know, just to strip it down to the original. It's easier just to strip the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like I say, they dabble in antiques, and I think they might have done some of that with furniture too. So they were, you know, they were pretty adept at whatever, you know, techniques they used to do it.
Yeah.
They didn't know who had made them, and I didn't know who had made them. It took me another 10 years to figure out Gus Smoke from the Lake Poygan that he did them.
Yeah. So when did you start? I guess, so you're kind of just acquiring when you're younger, just like everything and anything. And then, so when did you start becoming interested in the carver of the decoy and start doing the research side of it?
Well, we had moved out 30 miles west of Milwaukee by that time. I was probably 17, 18. And some friends of mine, I started trap shooting, and one or two guys that weren't much older than I were, they had collections of a sort, and they gave me two names of dealers that did nothing but deal in, well, not exclusively, but mostly decoys. And I would go up to see one. There was Elise Sanborn up in the center part of the state, and I'd get there early in the morning. He had a big potbelly stove, and he'd sit there and he'd talk for, it seemed like, hours. And he knew the makers, he knew the history, and luckily I have a good memory for things like that. I really can't remember what my wife says from one day to the next, but the decoy thing sticks in my mind for forever. So he had many decoys, and he'd show them all, but he had a quirk where he didn't like to sell them. Sometimes he'd trade, but mostly he just liked to bring them out and talk to people, which is not the ideal way to run a shop, I guess. But around that time, I had friends that is kind of an antique picker and is part-time and would keep finding Mason decoys for me. So I had quite a few of them, and I decided to, after listening to Lee, to concentrate on Wisconsin birds. So I took just about every Mason and made a couple of humongous trades with them, and I'm sure he really got the better of him, because he was a wheeler dealer and I was just a rube, so to speak. And that's how I started knowing carvers and really looking for different carvers, local carvers. And there was another person north of Milwaukee, roughly the same way. He knew his decoys, and I spent time talking with him quite a bit. So it was basically these two antique dealers. My work schedule kind of precluded me from going to shows, although I did make the Wisconsin decoy show a number of times way back then, and that helped also.
So how did you meet those guys? How did you come across
them? Well, like I say, the trap shooting friends of mine told me about them. Okay. I just drove up. They each had shops, actually. The one guy north of Milwaukee, I wasn't quite sure where he was, and I happened to be driving that direction one day, and way off in the side of the road, the interstate road there was, I could see a farm and an outbuilding where the shingles were a different color to spell out the word decoys on top of the roof of this building. And I just about slammed my brakes down in the middle of the interstate. Got off on the next exit and doubled back, and this guy was extremely interesting. Elroy Pick was his name, and he had birds that I had just only dreamed about. At that time, I think some of the first decoy books were coming out, and if I was lucky, they'd have a couple pages on Wisconsin stuff, and Elroy actually had the decoys that were in these books, which was just fascinating to me. So I was able to buy quite a bit from him. And then other antique shops, you know, back in the day, antique shops were a little bit different than they are today. And they actually had, things you were looking for in them. One in particular always had decoys for me. So that's basically, and then, you know, much later, I picked up on a few more shows, and then the internet was big also.
Right.
eBay.
Right. So I'm guessing, since listening to you talk, you have a kind of a really good eye for it. So was eBay, could you pick it out much easier than others on that? I'm guessing you could take advantage of it a little more than some could.
Well, yeah, they always say if you're new to decoys, to watch out for eBay, and I wasn't. And I could pick out decoys. I'm not sure why, but obscure makers, that's kind of what I like, that still made a good decoy. I mean, there's some makers, I think everybody's heard of, at least in Wisconsin they have, but some of the lesser ones made just as nice a decoy, but they just made a rig for themselves or maybe a friend. They didn't sell them. There wasn't that many of them out there. And like I say, I have a memory for things like that. And I was able to pick quite a few out. And you got to keep, back in the day, they were right and left, you saw good decoys. But now you got to look past probably weeks before you see a decent thing. And those are the ones I like, the ones that hopefully nobody else notices. For one thing, they're cheaper.
Yeah. I noticed when I was looking through your Facebook feed, some of the funkier ones you have and the obscure ones. And I like those too. I don't know why, but they just appeal to me.
I've always liked the folky aspect of it. I mean, Wisconsin's got some unbelievable artists that made decoys that, you know, it looks like they're going to pick up and fly away. We had the trained art from Milwaukee, Owen Grammy and whatnot. And then the Norwegian farmers who were just natural artists in Stoughton, Wisconsin, that could paint like you can't believe. But I always like to get a decoy that, you know, some guy didn't quite have that talent, but he had a lot of imagination, maybe. I don't know. And sometimes they look funny, which doesn't bother me in the least.
Same, yeah. I do. I like them too. Yeah. I kind of prefer them. But not everybody does. Some people will say they're ugly, but I like them. I don't know why. They just have so much more character to me.
I think so, too. Some people maybe aren't quite sure and need an exact reproduction of something to assure them that's a good bird. I'm not sure.
Maybe. That's a good way of thinking about it. I've never thought about it that way. Like, especially if you're... And I don't want to, put words in anyone's mouth, but, like, if you're collecting for, I don't know, to have a valuable collection, that might be a way of looking at it to make sure you're getting that. I mean, it's not necessarily always the case either. Some of the folky ones can be
that's
valuable.
That's definitely true. Yeah, if you're looking to definitely not lose money and possibly make quite a bit of money, you have to go where the money is, I think. And I don't sell decoys, so I'm not really concerned about that. I don't want to grossly overpay for something, but that never really bothered me, the possibility of not being able to recoup what I pay for it. So that's one thing I think you need if you jump into obscure or folky type decoys, is that attitude.
Right, yeah, you just need to like it. That's really the only thing you have to go for.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from the day one. If you don't buy anything you don't like, and that's definitely true.
I just never thought about it that way. And that's an interesting way to think about it. So you say you don't sell anything, but I'm guessing you've always just traded then for stuff?
Like, I have traded some. But recently, I've started to sell a little bit more, but I don't know. When I do go to shows, I don't set up to sell. I go in the anticipation of buying more. I don't know what that means. They're all a lot of decoys. They come with a story of how I got them, and they're part of a collection, and everything seems to fit. And sometimes I have a hard time letting go of anything. In the last few years, I parted with a few. Some I really regret.
Did you part with them to get other things? Have you used your collection in that way?
I'll say the thing that I got rid of that probably bothers me the most. I traded to a guy. It was a good trade. He gave me it was an Evans decoy, Evans Mallard, an old time Evans with, I'm not sure the terminology that Evans collectors use, loop painting or whatever.
Yeah,
and he gave me a newer hen, and I think it was $1,000 cash to boot for this. And it still didn't want to trade it. It was a type of mallard that a lot of people call black ducks and still do, but I think they're mallards. But anyway, this guy that wanted it, done it, sold a lot to me, and considered me to sell before anybody else. I felt I owed him at least that. So I did trade it. And I kind of wish I had that one back, I think, of any.
So you made a comment a second ago about like how, you know, items have a story. They're part of a collection, which makes me curious. Did you, before you, like even earlier as a kid, did you always collect things? Did you, or did you just tend to get, like, were you a collector from day one?
I guess I'm trying to think of what, baseball cards, like most kids. Yeah. I think that was it. I can't remember collecting too much other stuff. Most of my, especially my relatives out east, they all collected things. I think antiques meant more to them than my parents. So I wasn't really, other than decoys, I wasn't really brought up into, yeah, you know, accumulating quite a bit of stuff. I, over the years, you know, I had such as duck hunting guns. I never felt the same way about guns as I do decoys. I never liked to trade anything that I can't go right out and buy again. So I kept a lot of guns over the years. But that was all later, you know, once I had a job and could buy things on my own, especially. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. And I was just curious because a lot of times these collectors have like always collected things, or it's just something that's part of them. And I was just wondering because, yeah, but you started so young with decoys, so that's a little different. I mean, you're probably you might be the youngest like decoy collector I've talked to.
That could be.
Yeah. Like a 10 is very young to have. I mean, I've heard of people having one decoy as a kid and then, like, you know, when they got to be in their 20s, have a job, that's different.
Yeah, I developed my philosophy of decoy collecting way back then. If one is nice, two is nicer, and then just keep progressing there. that surprised me as I look back at it, because, you know, I did had a normal childhood. I played sports and whatnot, and yet our living room had decoys all around. I think there was a plate rail up there. Had decoys all around the plate rail. I can't say that there was hardly days went by where I wouldn't go up and look at them. So they did mean something to me.
Yeah. I mean, you're also in Wisconsin and you're duck hunting. It's not that unusual. And you've stayed in Wisconsin. Have you stayed in Wisconsin your whole life?
I have lived in Wisconsin. I lived in, because I was born in Milwaukee, then moved out to Aldo, Conemaugh, and which is closer to the Rock River Valley where Horicon and everything is. And I hunted through that time. And then I think it was right after I first got a fairly decent job, I bought a cabin on the Mississippi River right on the backwaters. And I used that for hunting and fishing and just laying around for many years. And my wife and I remodeled it probably in the 90s. And it's where we still live today. So I have the Mississippi River right at my doorstep. There's nothing between me and the water, at least the backwaters, and I can look out across about a mile of those and see the Minnesota Bluffs over there. It's just the ideal place. Ducks just about every time of year, which I enjoy watching them probably more than I do hunting them nowadays.
Yeah, that's pretty typical, though.
Yeah, I guess as you get older, I think that's the case. Right up to, I think, the 2020, that was the year of COVID, I think I'd gone to Canada hunting for a week, probably 20-some years in a row, maybe 25 years. And we'd go to Manitoba, which DU has a tremendous presence where we were. Every farm had a DU project, and I believe there was a couple plots of land that DU owned entirely. A lot of, everywhere you'd turn, there was a DU sign, and we had a great time up there. I had certain farms that we knew the farmers well, and it was just a great time. And then COVID came, and I never did go back, and now I'm kind of on the downward slide of hunting. I go out a couple times a year for divers, canvasbacks mostly, and mostly to get the dog out and get her excited.
Yeah, you have a golden, don't you? Is that what you have, a little golden?
Over the years, I had, I think, 3 labs, a Chesapeake, 4 goldens, and an English cocker even thrown in.
Do you have a favorite breed then, since you've hunted with all those dogs?
I like them all. I would never criticize another dog, but I've grown up them and I love Goldens. The four we've had have been great. They've all been great dogs. One was the, I suppose everybody says this, but the best hunter I'd ever seen. She was just obsessed with it. And she would go through those prime years up in Canada, and boy, we just had a ball. She'd run those prairies up there, picking up ducks and shooting Hungarian partridge and sharp tails, which they call big and little chickens up there.
Yeah, so,
yeah, I can still see her just tearing across us. She was in seventh heaven. I guess I was too.
We just lost our Golden, which was my first like dog as like an adult like that I had. She lived for 14 years, so I was pretty happy to have her, but. Yeah, I'm partial to them. I like them too. I like the Goldens, but I grew up with Labs, and I mean they're all good dogs. But
they are.
I'm partial to the.
Yeah, they're not a dog I didn't like, and I look back and they're all. I think of them as all great. Some of them are definitely greater than others as far as hunting ability, but they're all good companions. And the Goldens I've had, all four of them, their noses are just unbelievable. I guess. The only drawback is their coat. I would do sharptail hunting up in Canada. They had these, you know, these big red things like sandburrs. And if I'd hunt an hour, it'd take me 2 hours to get them out, and yep. I'd be bleeding. She'd be bleeding.
Yeah. All the burrs. Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, John, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Stay tuned to the Ducks Unlimited podcast, sponsored by Purina Pro Plan, after these messages. You and your dog are a team. Fuel is best in the field and in life with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Made for hardworking dogs of all ages, every sport formula starts with real meat as the number one ingredient and is specifically formulated to support strength and stamina. Try it today and see why Pro Plan is the official dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Learn more at proplansport.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I am still here with John Fandry, the Wisconsin decoy collector. So I have a question, John. I know a good bit about Evans Factory decoys. We had Terry Smart's collection in the museum, and I've had John Munson on. So I've talked to a few people about Evans decoys in particular, but I don't know, and honestly, I kind of get them confused with Minnesota decoys. Is there anything particular that, besides being from Wisconsin, of course, that is unique to Wisconsin decoys? Can you describe that a little bit for me?
I can. I think Wisconsin, probably like most states, I think has different areas that require a different bird. I think, different decoy. The first area that be collected was the Big Lake Winnebago and the surrounding lakes. And it's big, rough water, and they mostly were diver hunters, and they wanted high backs and high heads and big decoys to be seen in the waves.
That's what comes to my brain, like to my eye, when I think of Wisconsin. Okay.
Sure. That's the area where they were used. And little north of that is another big decoy area, which has been Green Bay. And roughly it's the same type of water, but the decoys weren't quite as big. I'm not sure the reason why, but canvasbacks and bluebills were the main birds. And then the area I'm in now, the Mississippi River, is kind of an extension of the Illinois. I think the birds are smaller, thinner maybe, painted much nicer, sometimes even varnished to show up in the backwater potholes, tree-lined potholes. Mostly puddle ducks, a lot of mallards, and even some black ducks, I believe. And then Milwaukee area was going to be another one. They're noted for the museum carvers. There was a group of taxidermists and artists led by Owen Grammy. And all extremely well done. These people knew what birds looked like. And they were most of them were laminated, horizontally laminated out of pieces of wood. And there is a also another tool company in Milwaukee, Delta Tool, who put out plans to make a decoy kind of modeled after that. So you'd actually can see find those just about anywhere. And another maker from Milwaukee, James Walton, he made a similar decoy, again laminated, very nicely done and painted.
Why would it have been laminated? What was the?
Well, you take the bottom piece would be, they had a pattern, so you easily draw out a pattern on a piece of 1x pine or cedar, and then each middle piece would be cut a little bit smaller size, and the middle would be cut out, so it'd be an easy way to hollow a bird.
Okay.
Then top would be solid again, so it'd be like making a sandwich where the inside of the sandwich, only the edges are shown.
So it's just like a simpler way of hollowing a decoy.
Yeah, there's a pattern to follow. You don't have to rely quite as much on your artistic ability, I guess.
Okay.
And James Walton actually conducted classes for many years in the high school or night classes or whatever. And so there are many, many people that made decoys that model after his. Some is nice, some not as nice. You'll see, find some that the person was so happy with what he made in class, they went right to his mantle, and some were used for many years and are pretty worn and beat. So it's it was all kinds that were making the decoys.
So were they tacking all those laminations together, or like I just imagine
they would
if you
be,
x-ray that thing, it's full of...
I believe they would be glued. Maybe the top and bottom might have been nailed in there.
Okay.
I actually, when I'm going through this, I forgot two very important areas here.
Okay.
It's the Koshkonong, Lake Koshkonong area, which is a whole story in itself. That was featured in, I think, last year's decoy, North American Decoy Show. The decoys are much older. Possibly some of the early ones came from Chesapeake Bay, and after that, the local carvers kind of followed that pattern. So they look like, actually, like Upper Bay birds, a lot of them, and they're old. They can go back to 1870 and probably up to the 20s. And then, of course, not too far from that area would be the Stoughton School with the Hami brothers and Enoch Reindel.
Okay,
probably considered considered the best of Wisconsin carvers, and rightfully so. Probably they're extremely talented guys. And simple people. That was an amazing thing about it. They were just Norwegian farmers and lived in a, you know, one with Enoch Reindel was a bachelor farmer, and you know what their houses probably would look like. And I guess that's what his did look like.
Yeah.
But he was able to turn out these works of art, and everything he did was a work of art. He made musical instruments, he did flat work, he was a photographer, just a kind of a genius in hiding, I guess you might say.
Yeah. Do you think they were influenced by anybody? I was just thinking, Reindel's stuff is beautiful. And do you think they had seen other decoys? They were influenced by anything?
As far as Stoughton School, I don't believe they were. Actually, Reindel probably was an influencer of anything. I think he got his local friends to carve. And he also did an article in Field and Stream showing how he did carve.
Right.
I think he pretty much developed the stuff. He's, like I say, he was a great photographer, and he probably knew pretty much what a bird looked like, you know, from his photography.
Right.
And he was able to.
That makes sense. Yeah. And I wonder, he hunted as well too, right? So I'm sure he kept birds and figured out, knowing what they look like.
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be interesting. I'd like to know and go back to know why he did such detail in his decoys, because his are very detailed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he lived to be a ripe old age, and there was a lot of active collectors hanging around him when he was still alive. So they could glean a lot of information. A lot is known about him, and it's a good thing, because he's worth knowing about for sure.
Yeah, no, he's special. He is special, that's for sure. Yeah, I was just looking at the Canada goose pair that's that big blue wildfowl decoy book. I can't think of what it is. It's a huge.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just, that has the pair of his Canada geese in it. And yeah, they stick out compared to the rest of Wisconsin decoys.
They sure do. you know, a lot of people think they're the best. I think one of those birds ended up in the McCleary collection in Texas and was worth a lot of money. I think at some auctions they were a Rheingold goose brought more than a Cobb goose, Cobb Virginia Cobb Island goose. I don't, they don't, still don't bring the amount that Kroll geese would bring, but he's been collected for years, and I think the clientele is, you know, a wider clientele. That's a lot of people know him.
Right. The Crowell just carries a name, right? Like it's not even just the goose, but his name is also worth something.
That too. Yeah. But certainly, you know, if you took a person that didn't know names or values or anything and showed them a Rheingold goose and a Elmer Crowell goose, who's to say what he would think? That you could go either way on which is best. That's my opinion anyway.
I agree. It's, I mean, they're great decoys. Yeah, I definitely agree. So where was Moke from? Because you mentioned him, and I don't know. What area was he from? Because his stuff's so different.
Moke was from a little town called Tustin. I had very few people in it. It's on the far western edge of Lake Poygan, which is part of the chain that ends, well, starts, there's two rivers that come through the state, the Wolf and the Fox, and they kind of meet and form these big lakes at Poygan, Winneconne, Butamore, and then Lake Winnebago, which is huge. And then the Fox River leaves that for Green Bay. So it would be at the far western edge of these central Wisconsin lakes. And he was also a farmer. And the little town of Tustin not only had him, but Joe Seeger. I don't know if you're familiar with that name. His high back, high neck hands are probably the epitome of a Wisconsin decoy. I think they're extremely sought after. And he was from the same little town. Of, you know, I'm not sure the population can't be more than 100 or two.
Right. I'm guessing. So, okay, when you say that, but they're all these guys are farmers, and then they're also making decoys. So, and I think about, I'm from Mississippi, from the Delta, and, you know, here it's not quite the same, but a lot of people who farm, they lease their property out to hunters, or some even have, you know, they'll guide during the off season. So is that what is happening at that time in Wisconsin? Like they're farming during the, you know, the spring, summer, fall, and then switching over to waterfowl for their occupation?
I would say no.
No, okay.
Around Horicon Marsh, land was leased for goose hunting. Very seldom did leasees do anything like control water or plant crops for, you know, just for geese or whatever. Most of Wisconsin hunting, I believe, would be public hunting, is my opinion. That's most of what I've done. I know of some clubs in the old days, and I'm sure there's clubs nowadays, but they're kind of low-key, nothing to like what's down south, they're not even close, and nothing like what's in Illinois, I don't believe. You know, along the river where I've hunted for the last 40 years here is strictly public hunting. It's all public land owned by the government. And some of the bottoms are privately owned, not that many, and those are leased. But again, nothing. So, you know, the hunters changed the landscape to attract ducks. They just wanted the access, the exclusive access to an area, I think, is why anything would be leased up here.
Right.
Over the years, I hunted one type of club. My father had a friend that he and a group of guys had a so-called club on a lake near Horicon, Fox Lake, it was called. And this was probably like an old southern club. They had bunk houses, like about 8 or 9, and a clubhouse with a kitchen in it. And I stayed there and permanent blinds in the marsh that they controlled. And I stayed there for one weekend. It was kind of strange to, you know, to stay in a blind and to have rules. you're kind of a freelancer, even. Not that you're breaking law, but you're making your own rules or punt or what you want to shoot at. They were good rules. I mean, you got to keep some sense of order there. But it was a fun new experience for me, and it was a fun trip. They had even had a caretaker that stayed out there to make sure nobody wandered in from off the lake when supposed to be.
I'm sure you didn't have to get up nearly as early either.
That was the thing I liked about Canada. I never hardly ever saw another hunter. Nowadays, out in the river here, you have to be up at 3 o'clock in the morning. If not, some guys stay overnight out there.
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting here watching them because I can see them right from my front yard, and they can put a whole day in of not shooting anything, and then right back the next day they're out at 2 o'clock. So yeah, they're hard.
Because I work in the Pyramid, and a lot of the guys who work at Bass Pro and the Waterfront, they all do the public land in Arkansas, and I'm spoiled. I grew up in Mississippi and on private land, and my mom and dad, well, now they currently live at our duck camp. They just retired there, but before that, they lived 10 minutes away from our duck camp, so I've never gotten up before 5.
Yeah, you had it made, that's for sure. You read these books about the big leisurely breakfast. Well, you know, when I was hunting hard and heavy here, I'd be up at probably 4:30 or 5, and, I don't know, grab a cookie or something, and I'd be out there, dog in the boat and heading out there. But, you always have that to worry about, someone coming in next to you, or, you know, you never know what you're liable to meet out there. Somebody's shooting at every goes by, but that's the price you pay for public.
So back to these carvers. What would you say the percentages are like making it for private use versus selling their decoys to hunters? Like, are the majority of Wisconsin carvers making them for private use, or are they?
I believe they do. I think the majority made them for themselves. These are all little towns, and maybe help friends. Maybe they did it in a communal way. A couple of cases I can think of, but there's an awful lot of them. You know, once I started posting on Facebook, I'd get some comments from out east that just about everybody in Wisconsin seemed to have made decoys. And a lot that nobody had ever heard of. And I think that's the case. Gus Moak was a commercial maker. He sold decoys for, I think, $48 a dozen back in the day. And there's some of the Green Bay makers did a lot and sold a lot. Milwaukee carvers, all those museum guys, I don't believe they sold birds at all. Just help people out. And Rindle, I don't think he ever sold a bird. I think he would give a few to friends and maybe replace a rig with a new rig. But that's probably one of the reasons that Wisconsin lagged so far behind everybody else, that there wasn't the real commercial maker to put out a lot of people could see them. I think definitely it was that farmer that trying to earn, you know, or, you know, make his own stuff, or maybe in Moak's case, earn a few extra bucks that did these things. And it seemed like just about a lot of the guys that hunted did do that. It's kind of amazing to me. And they did a good job. You would think that, some of the Oshkosh carvers, I think Frank Stry made rigs, and you see a lot of different brands on them. And most of those are known by now who they are. And I think Gus Nilo, that was another big name. I don't know if I mentioned him. He made an awful lot of birds, probably as many as anybody in Wisconsin. Typical big, high-headed, mostly diver ducks. And he would birds too.
Looking through your Facebook post, and you mentioned about, I can't remember what carver it was, but you posted like it was like a wood duck and a widgeon and maybe a gadwall. Mm-hmm. And you said something about how they were rare to see Wisconsin, or they, and I don't know if it was just that carver or Wisconsin in general, but it was a real short post. So I was trying to figure out. So was that like, was there a lot of those species or no?
There was a lot of the species, but people didn't make decoys for them. It was a kind of a no frills thing. I think the widgeon or a gadwell would come into a mallard just as fast. Right.
We just use mallard decoys down here. We don't really, some people do. Some people put all the species out there, but I grew up, the only decoys we ever put out were maybe some teal decoys, but that was about it. Part of me was wondering if the reason they didn't make them as well was because y'all hunted earlier in the season and they weren't as colorful then, maybe. Is that what could that?
That's definitely true. Although I think the car, the makers, when they did make them, seemed to make them in full plumage.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I noticed throughout the years in my decoy rig, I always added a couple Drake pintails, mainly for the white. Yeah. The Widgeon would come in there faster than anything, and that's what I had them for. Yeah, we very seldom saw a white, a full plumage Drake pintail, but they drew other birds in just by being white, and I think that might have been the case in some. And speaking of that, why I'm thinking of it, Wisconsin carvers are known for coot decoys.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I forget about that. Yeah.
And, I was going to say they drew a lot of different birds in, too, but I'm sure that was the case in a lot of them. But Wisconsin, though, has a lot of German people, a lot of immigrants, and they ate coots. And
okay, that's what I was going to ask. I assume they were just confidence decoys, but they're actually... use them for both?
It would be my guess that as many people wanted to eat the coots as wanted to fool a duck with the coot decoy. I've eaten it, and I've known many other people that have.
I just find it so funny to think. I mean, we actually haven't seen that many coots in the last couple of years. It's been weird, but I've always had, I mean, just rafts of them. I mean, they're everywhere. And
yeah.
My brother and I used to joke when we were like growing up that, because I think they say they migrate at night, so you never see them flying. And we used to joke.
No, you don't.
Yeah, we used to joke they popped up from under the ground. That's why they were black. They came from underneath. They just popped up one day.
I don't. There was a lot of decals on cars back in the days. Eat more coot. At least for duck hunters. Most people didn't put that on there, but duck hunters had that. And a quick story here. A friend of my father's, his father was quite a bit older than he was. And we call him a Dutchman. I think he was just an old German guy. He still spoke with an accent. But on a Monday, after a busy weekend of hunting, he would drive up to Lake Puckaway, which is also up to the north, central part of the state, big hunting area. And he would rent a skiff and paddle around the lake. I don't think he even brought a gun. And he would pick up the dead coots that were shot during the week and take them home. And I know the English... the English used to hang birds till the bodies dropped away from the heads. They used to nail their heads to the wall. These were pre-aged, I think.
Oh my
I don't
goodness.
Know if he picked the ones with the moss growing on them or not, if they were better.
At least it's cold
we told
up
that
there.
Story.
I can't even imagine. Have you eaten a coot? I've never eaten a coot.
I have. Again, a friend of my father. These were all Depression-era guys, and they would... probably ate anything, and they would come up here to the river in later years to deer hunt, and the one guy would bring a big kettle of coot stew. He thought he was treating everybody, but everybody else was kind of shaking their heads at it, but that I ate, and it was good. They disguised it in so many, or his wife did, in so many ways, ginger snaps, and I don't know what all else, and it was good. I can't say I don't go running to eat some today, but with everybody sitting around a table telling stories, it was edible for sure.
So I have a funny story, and I'm going to admit to my wrongdoing as a child, but I've never told this. I don't even think my dad knows, but we always were told when we were kids, you shoot it, you eat it, and it was always like a big rule. So my cousin and I, we were probably, I don't know, 10, 11, maybe 11, 12. And it was youth day. And the duck, we were hunting this pit blind at my cousin's house with our dads and his brother. And it was getting later in the morning. The ducks stopped coming in. But there was just a bunch of ducks were down the ditch line from us. And we were getting ready to go. And we begged them if we could go sneak down the ditch and shoot the ducks down there, get them up. He was like, yeah, whatever, y'all go do it. If you get anything, bring it back. Because we were about to leave to go home. So we sneak down the ditch, and it's really shallow water right there. So most of it is iced over, and there's a little bit of open water where all the ducks are. And there's a bunch of coots in there too. And we both lay on the ditch line, lay on the levee and shoot. And I don't know which one of us hit the coot, but one of us killed a coot. And we both probably, and then one of us probably just shot straight over. But we were so scared that they were going to make us eat it because we had heard that they were terrible, that we took that coot and we hit out a little thing of ice and shoved it under the ice.
Oh, boy. And went back out on a real treat there.
And told our dads that we just missed. And then they made fun of us for missing all those things. And we never told them that we killed that coat. So yeah, I don't recommend doing that, kids, but I did it.
No. I got the same eat what you shoot lecture right when I started hunt. You don't shoot anything without eating it. And before the duck season, we would go up to the farm and some of the other farms and shoot barnyard pigeons,
right?
Which we had to eat. And I'd recommend a coot before that. maybe it was prepared. They didn't taste that terrible. It was kind of like chewing on a tennis ball, if that. I mean, these things were tough. And I imagine you could have disguised that a little bit, but I don't think my mother had the skills to do it.
That's funny. Yeah, I've never told anyone that story. So, yep, we just shoved it under the ice and lied.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, we were probably like fifth, sixth grade. I think that's how we were young.
Sure.
Okay, so I have a question before we go, which I've never gotten anyone to really. I've read a few articles about it, but this is really off topic. But you're from Wisconsin and you grew up hunting public land. All right, tell me about marsh skis. What are marsh skis? Do people actually use them? Do you fall in the water?
Yeah. again, a friend of mine, after we started goose hunting, I got a little older and I had this urge to convince my father to go out in a boat in Horicon, which is the way we hunted for many years. And a friend of mine would have marsh skis, and that's the only way he would hunt. And he would go out there before the season and he would make trails through the cattails.
Okay.
And then for maybe three or four times during the year, I would go with him. And it once the trails are made, it's not that hard. These are, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're like cross-country skis on steroids. Quite a bit wider.
We have a pair in the museum.
And the bindings are just a loop of fire hose or something or whatever, and your feet aren't in there permanently. So you shuffle along. You don't really ski. You just kind of shuffle. And if you come to a pothole and something jumps, you shoot. If you come to a pothole and want to hunt it, you just stop there. And you can put your two skis together, kind of, and you're basically standing on a piece of board.
Okay, so you continue to stand on the board if you stop there.
Yep.
Okay, that's one thing I was trying to figure out. Like, did you get to the pothole and it was like the water wasn't that deep, so you just got down? Or,
well, in Horicon, there was no such thing as, or very rare, to wade. Once you got away from those skis, you were going down God knows how far.
Okay.
Anywhere from the top of your waders to over your head in muck.
Okay.
So you didn't want to get out and wade at all. There was spots that you could, but mostly you stayed on that, used it as a solid platform. The dogs would actually sit on them, on the back part of them.
I was assuming you had to have a dog if you're hunting in these things.
Yeah.
Because how else would you get cripples?
It, definitely the dog. Horicon Marsh was a cattail marsh, and the potholes were nice and open, but once you left there, there was no little pockets of water. It was just about solid. And you definitely needed a dog. And we had dogs all in place and some good. You needed a tough dog, a big, strong, tough dog, or a wiry, at least wiry and strong.
Yeah.
And when I went with this guy, we always went with his dog. I never took ours, just the one. And he always had, he liked to mix Goldens and Black Labs. That was his thing. Always good. Fabulous dog. And your shooting was easy. You had jump shooting, which is never really difficult. And then the birds were always coming back into the pothole. So we didn't use decoys, but you could have. But that was, easy too. And this guy, I don't know what he'd end up the season with, but I don't think he probably missed more than four or five times through a whole season. He had all these shots. And it was kind of funny because we brought him up to the goose hunting farm one time. It was a whole different thing. And I think he went through a box of shells without getting a goose. That different, you know, you could see him coming and they were up there a little bit higher and he had time to think about it. And he just threw his momentum completely off. But jump shooting on skis is instinctive and hard work.
Yeah. How far would you go in those skis, like on a morning?
Oh, gosh. Quite a way. I think a whole circuit would probably take you at least a mile, maybe.
Okay. You just shuffle along.
You shuffle along. You didn't want to, you know, it was nice to stop every once in a while and hunt a pothole instead of just jump shooting it. Because they give you rest and they extend your hunt a little bit.
Yeah.
But he had a couple areas where he had made the trail. That was hard work. I mean, extremely hard work.
Yeah.
And following on those trails made it a lot easier. But I was in my 20s. I wouldn't, there's been many, many years where I wouldn't even attempt doing anything like that. No, it's definitely a young man's game, I think. I'm not even sure if people do that much anymore, to tell you the truth, but that is the Wisconsin thing.
Yeah.
We had makers up there that were known for that. I mean, people can identify certain skis by their maker and collect those. And I've had number of pairs over the years.
Yeah, we have a pair in the museum, but they've always just kind of, I don't know. The way you just described it then, I feel more confident with it. Because it's like, how did they do this and not get wet? Like, it just seems. But yeah, those cattails just hold you up, right? They just
hold. Yeah, they hold you up. You're in the bent over cattails. So you're not. Sometimes you got to go through channels where you can see your skis are being held or holding you up from the muck like 8 inches down.
Okay.
But you are thinking through that stuff. Or if you fell off, you'd get wet. you'd have to do some acrobatics to get yourself back going again.
Yeah.
But I never seen anybody fall. But I have to admit, it was always nice to get back to the boat and get the skis in the boat and then have a nice dry seat. And
it probably keeps you from getting cold.
Oh, definitely you wouldn't get cold. And you never see other hunters. I don't know if it was an unwritten law that people didn't use other people's trails or what, but I hadn't, all the time I'd hunted, I'd never seen another person doing that. And you're so far back there that you're hunting spots that nobody'd see. You'd shoot black ducks or crying out loud. They'd be sitting back there in bunches, you know, where they'd be scared to death to come near people out in the open. So it was
Yeah. And that's the point of them, right? The point is to be able to get to these spots and these potholes that you can't reach by boat and whatnot,
yeah.
Right?
So this guy knew where they were by experience. I imagine nowadays your Google Earth or GPS or drones or whatever can pick out every pothole for you back there. So there's no hiding for a duck anymore, kind of. But
yeah, I don't hear of anyone doing it, though. I don't know if it's just no one's taught anyone how to do it. I'm not sure, you know, because you think by now they'd start making, if people were doing it, there'd be some manufacturer making them. But
yeah,
I don't think they are.
You know, that area you skied, and if you wanted to go back into a pothole with a boat, you pulled, and you were quiet. You know, and I don't want to criticize anything, but I guess I am. Mud motors will take you back any place you want to go and sound like a Harley getting in there and scare everything out of its wits.
Right.
Not that if I was young, I'd probably have one myself, but being an old guy, I can complain about those things, I guess. But it makes it, I think it really does affect the ducks. I think it makes them more wary, sends them deeper into spots where they aren't going to see anybody, or like a refuge, and stay there. But it's a way of life now. So
yeah.
Like I say, I'm not.
Well, and it's different too, because again, you're thinking public land. This isn't, you're not hunting private land where you've, you know, put ag on it or anything like that. This is
sure.
Yeah. So that's different. There's not like they're coming back to that same food source over and over. Yeah. It's a different game, different strategy, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Before we go, because I haven't talked about it at all, and that's kind of why you're here. I know you don't go to the show. You haven't been going to the show recently, but because we're here to talk about the Chicago show and but you used to go to Pheasant Run, right, a lot.
I did. I went there quite a few years, and I do go to a few of the local shows. And I can't recommend them highly enough for a beginning collector. You know, if they have something they want ID'd, they have experts in any kind of a field. Or if you want to see things, again, you could see just about anything you can think of at that the Lombard show, which is the one coming up. It's like the Super Bowl of duck show or decoy shows. And sometimes it's overwhelming a little bit, maybe for a newcomer, but everybody makes you feel welcome. They have seminars that can teach seasoned collectors down to brand new collectors. It's a wonderful resource for any type of collector. They have other things besides decoys even nowadays, but you can find it all. It's a kind of mind-boggling. You just kind of settle yourself down.
Yeah. And I still have a question. Since you've been going to shows for a very long time, do you have a strategy about how you approach a show when you're looking for something?
Actually, my strategy is to contact the collectors that I know ahead of time and have things all lined up. That's the easy way to do it.
What about when you were young and you didn't know the collectors?
Well, way back when I would go and, it's just the hit and miss thing. I would walk around. I remember the first show I went to was in the Wisconsin show in the Pioneer Inn. I saw two decoys that were just jumped out at me. They were Frank Resop, which is still one of my favorite makers, canvasbacks. I forgot the price was a pittance compared to what they are now, but I think at the time I could only afford one. So I took it, and I was walking out. There was a collector, I think I'd even heard of him, a guy from Milwaukee. He says, "I think you've got one of the best decoys for sale here." He said, "I was eyeing that for the last couple of days." So that made me feel good. I knew what looked like. Still one of my favorite birds, actually. That way, I had no idea. I wasn't looking for a particular thing. It just was something that would catch my eye. I knew I wanted Wisconsin. I always, canvasbacks always seemed to catch my eye. So odds are it's going to be a nice big can. Once I got into it, I knew the collectors. I knew what they had for sale, and I'd kind of arrange ahead of time. But I'd still go the room to room, and you never know. I found some amazing stuff in there. You never know what you're going to find. I don't set up a table to sell, so I got plenty of time to to look to buy. I don't think I've ever been to a show where I didn't come away with a couple prizes that I was really happy with.
Do you have one in particular, one like decoy you found, like that you were surprised by?
Well, actually, that first Resop, well, yes, there is one. It's an embarrassing story here, but this last Minnesota show, I was picking up some birds that I won in an auction. They were being delivered. They're actually from Terry Smart Collection. And I recognized one as being one of my favorite makers from near Horicon, George Stofflet, his name was. And the auction had it with three other decoys. It, you know, didn't look like much unless you knew what you're looking for. And so I had to buy four decoys to get the one. And it had it listed as a seagull decoy. And I picked it up, and at first glance, it looked like a seagull. It was that size, maybe like a big duck, maybe. And brought it back to the room, and I was rooming with Nils Swenson, and he said, "I think that's a snow goose." And I was so blinded by the auction description, and I don't know, it was in my mind, it was a seagull. I said, "No, that's a seagull." Well, I made the mistake of putting it on the Facebook page where I was politely reminded by about 100 people that it was a snow goose. And I didn't know the difference between a seagull and a snow goose. Well, it was kind of embarrassing, but not that. I took it well. I was actually happy with a snow goose.
Well, you paid them back today with your April Fool's post.
Yeah. Yeah, they fell for that one. I was happy it was a snow goose. It's still a very rare bird, and I guess you got to stop and think of what you got instead of going at first glimpse of it. But yeah, this Illinois show is, like I say, for any collector, it's just an amazing thing. The room to room is so much fun. you get to talk to these people at, not with, a dozen people looking at them, but maybe one or two in there talking. And it's just, you can see everything from classic birds to beginning junkers. And the auction that they hold there, they have a preview the night before, and you can actually get close, with these classic birds, birds worth, $200,000 a piece maybe. And that I've always enjoyed that, seeing things that you'd never in a million years, have a chance to own, but
right.
to get right up. Yeah. It's an interesting show.
Yeah. It's a good collection this year too, for that's being sold. That.
Yeah. The Alan Haid collection. He was collecting probably right when I started. I think he wrote one of the first books that had a semblance of Wisconsin stuff in it. And he was quite a collector, had a great eye, and he made his life as a dealer and collector, knew exactly what he was looking for. And there's some classics that are finally hitting the market. I'm sure they'll bring a fair amount.
Oh yeah.
I can only dream about.
I did get to see, and I've already mentioned it on here in another interview, but I was at John Dieter's house in the fall, and he had that black duck crow preening bird there, and I got to hang out with it for a little bit, which was nice.
Yeah, and I've read Decoy Magazine since it came out, and there's stories on that makes it even nicer, to get the background of it. And classic birds. It'll be interesting to see who's shelling out the money. I think there's quite a bit of a resurgence in decoys here since COVID, I believe.
It has been, it has. Yeah. It's really gone up and steadily been going up, which has been, along with flat art as well, which has been nice to see. Like Rami's stuff has really jumped since COVID as well. We talked about him a little bit, but it's really jumped. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on. Before we go, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would like our listeners to know about?
Well, actually, I thought it would be hard for me to talk for this period of time, but I'm thinking of other things, but nothing earth-shattering. But it was a pleasure talking to you.
Yes,
and you made it extremely, extremely easy to do this.
Yeah.
You'd probably do this often, though, I would imagine. But
this is the best thing about my job, is getting to hear y'all's stories and talk to you and get to meet all these new people. And I love it so much. So thank you so much for sharing your time.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, John, for coming on the show. Thank you, Chris, our producer, and thanks to you, our listener, supporting wetlands and waterfowl conservation.
Thank you for listening to the DU Podcast, sponsored by Purina Pro Plan, the official performance dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Purina Pro Plan, always advancing. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit ducks.org/DU Podcast. Opinions expressed by guests do not necessarily reflect those of Ducks Unlimited. Until next time, stay tuned to the Ducks. You and your dog are a team. Fuel is best in the field and in life with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Made for hardworking dogs of all ages, every sport formula starts with real meat as the number one ingredient and is specifically formulated to support strength and stamina. Try it today and see why ProPlan is the official dog food of Ducks Unlimited. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com.